Saving money in your next painting project now at Menards. From your kitchen and bath to doors and trim and even your ceilings, Dutch Boy has the perfect finish for your painting projects. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a tough paint and primer that provides great scrub resistance and durability. Save big on Dutch Boy paints. Plus, view our weekly flyer on Menards.com and get your painting project started today. Save big money
at Menards. Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, clinicians, investors and generally leaders of the health tech space in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners will know, I am a founder and CEO of my own health tech business called PocDoc, who kindly support the show. We can get more into that as the show goes on. Thank you very much to the PocDoc team. Also, as ever, thank you very much to everybody who's listening live on UK Health Radio. Johan and his team do a fantastic job. It's also, I'm sure some of you would like to know, it's not just me on UK Health Radio. There are many other presenters doing many other fantastic shows. Also, thank you very much if you're listening after the fact on Catch Up on Spotify, YouTube, or any of the other podcast channels. Search for Health Tech Hour and you'll find us. You'll find my smiling face. We really appreciate you tuning in. Without you guys, we wouldn't have a show. And actually, this last couple of weeks, I've realized that when I pulled the stats that we've added Saudi Arabia to the 45 countries that listen every single month and download the show every single month. So thank you very much, Saudi Arabia, and all of our listeners there. And one more thing just to let everybody know. All of the shows, not just our show, all of the UK Health Radio shows are available for download on the UK Health Radio section of Spotify and other podcast platforms. So you can download it directly from the Health Tech Hour channel or from the channel of UK Health Radio. So on to today's show. Now, it's been a while since we've had an investor on. We always like getting investors on because I feel like it's one of those areas where there's sort of a relatively accepted understanding that in order to grow a business, you need investment. I think that beyond that, for the majority of people, there's a bit of a lack of clarity around exactly how it happens and why it happens and how it all flows through. And I think obviously in the current climate, that it was obviously the economy is in a bit of a strange situation, both here and in the US. And so I think it's a really good opportunity to get an investor on. And what an investor. So we've got Chris Bischoff, who's the MD of General Catalyst, on the show, longtime investor in health technology, healthcare, not just at General Catalyst, but previously. So the list of businesses that either he has or, you know, in his role at GC or General Catalyst or in other places invested in includes Thriver, Cityblock, Elena Health, Livongo, Babylon and Village MD, which is quite a list. So we'll be getting into a number of different issues throughout the show. But Chris, thank you very much for coming on the show. Welcome to the Health Tech Hour.
Great pleasure, Steve. I'm happy to be on and looking forward to a good discussion.
Good. Well, look, let's kick off things. So as I said, I think a lot of people probably listening, we're a very broad church on the show. So we have people that are from a health technology background, from a clinical background, people that are just generally interested in health. I think by now, there's probably a reasonably high understanding or like awareness of this venture capital space, okay, of that it exists and that it funds businesses and it funds, well, a huge number of businesses that we interact with today as a consumer or as a patient or whatever it happens to be. So what I'd really like to start with is what was your pathway into that space? How did that happen? What was your journey into venture capital?
Great question. So I came to investing when I was relatively old, relative to most startup investors. I'd spent 13 years at Goldman Sachs, running a team on the investment banking side. Prior to that, I was at business school, and prior to that, I was consulting. So I spent a long while sort of figuring out what I wanted to do. And I reached a point where it was really important for me to do something I really felt passionate about, and I felt I could have, you know, real impact in. And healthcare and investing was really the combination of those two things. I had thought about investing a number of times in my career, but I always delayed the decision to go into investing because I always thought, hey, I need some more skills before I do so. And I've greatly benefited, I think, from my history in sort of services, whether consulting and then banking, in the sense that I think all investors ultimately need to be service providers to entrepreneurs. And if you think you are the capital provider and that's the end of the job, you are, you know, wildly mistaken.
I think that's really interesting. So when you said that you felt like you wanted to add more skills, what did you feel like you were lacking or that you wanted to add on before you made that leap across?
So when I was a consultant, I learned how to prepare PowerPoint decks, as consultants tend to, and encapsulate messages in sort of pithy one-liners. More seriously, think about industry strategically. And then banking gave me some experience of transacting, but it also gave me experience of working with CEOs and management teams on highly complex and difficult decisions, right? Ultimately, as a banker, you are advising on an M&A situation, an IPO situation, a strategic investment area. So you think quite heavily around capital allocation and then how to make things happen. You obviously don't actually make things happen because you're not in these companies, but you've got to come with real ideas and you've got to develop a real empathy and a rapport with the CEO of a business to be taken seriously. And I think, fundamentally, that is true of working with founders. You've got to build the rapport. You've got to build that safe space. You've got to deliver tough messages sometimes, but in the end of the day, you've got to come from a point of understanding them and their journey and the business's journey. And I think that sort of experience, if you will, of this service provider has been extremely helpful to me. Above all, because I've always looked at at backing founders who I think I can help mature on their journey and bring some of the experiences I've got. The other thing is to say is that you get a great business understanding in banking and consultancy, and healthcare is a business in the end of the day. And I know we all look at it as a passion project and an impact project, but in the end of the day, to be sustainable, we need to make these things viable and, really understanding what makes a business viable financially, I think is an important part of it too.
Yeah. And I think that's really interesting. There's a few things in there just to pick up on. So I've always been a big believer that there's money and then there's smart money, and I think that one of the things that people underestimate is that value that investors can bring, particularly VC investors. And so I think it's interesting that you bring that up as a major point right out the gate around your experience in those other sectors led to you being able to add more value to founders. Is that something where you feel like there needs to be more of that in the investment space if people come in young and they haven't had quite that track record? Or what's your view on that? I'm sure there's lots of great young investors.
I think it depends. Look, I think as an investor, you have to choose your style of investing. At GC and myself through my career, and I can touch on sort of my early days of investing, I always chose to invest in businesses I truly believed in and that I was not going to invest in very many. And I was going to invest with the assumption that in areas like healthcare that are highly complex with long sales cycles, investors need to really engage in the business on a regular basis to support founders and their teams to build. That it's not like a SaaS business that just gets sold. And so a high volume approach to investing where you pick a number of companies, you see what works and you double down on what does work and you let go what doesn't. To me, that doesn't feel very personality-wise attuned with how I approach life, but also be very effective in healthcare. Healthcare is just too hard to do it that way. And I think what resonates in healthcare, the immense advantage in healthcare is that oftentimes we actually know the problem. It's not like building the next consumer app where some extraordinary entrepreneur finds a tool or device that nobody thought they needed, and then it becomes core to their everyday living. In healthcare, we know the problems, and so you can work back to think through the solutions. But it does, require much more effort to get there.
Yeah, and I think that as a health tech founder, I would completely agree with that. And it's definitely through our experience or my experience been that there are people that have they don't necessarily have to be clinicians or anything, but having some kind of understanding of the broader market conditions, route to market, duration, regulatory framework, all of those type of things within the healthcare space makes a big difference in terms of how you interact with those individuals and how much value they can bring to the business.
Yeah, so we've actually set up our business with the largest, maybe a little context on us. General Catalyst is the largest investor in VC and early growth in the world in healthcare. And we've set up our business to be very thematic focused. Everyone on our team, General Catalyst is a very large firm and it's multi-sectorial, but our healthcare team, which amounts to around 20 people now across the globe, are very sector focused and very thematically driven. And so we're trying to look for problems to solve, and ideally hard problems to solve. And then we bring, hopefully, our capabilities, our insight, our go-to-market experience, our operating partners to bear to help founders build in those sectors. So we've deployed that approach, and it all comes back to what we call a thesis of health assurance. So we're trying to assure better health. Health insurance sort of only works to some degree, right? Because it's sick care based, and we need to move to health assurance, and that's preventative care. So we have a sort of overall thesis, and that drives all our work from there, rather than trying to throw darts at a board.
Which is also a fairly well-trodden investment pathway, I suspect, perhaps less successful of just throwing darts at things. So when did you start to do your investments in health? Obviously, you were in consulting. That probably wasn't that investment focused. I don't know whether you worked on some healthcare.
So I got an opportunity in 2013. I was advising a large growth capital investor in Europe, Europe's largest growth capital investor, a firm called Kinnevik, based out of Sweden. And they asked me to join to really head up their investment team. And that was a terrific opportunity. I was a managing director at Goldman Sachs. It was a terrific opportunity to come into an incredibly entrepreneurial organization and really take the lead of shaping it in terms of where it invested. And that was an opportunity I jumped at. I sort of learned the investing ropes quite quickly. They had an existing portfolio of assets that I had to sort of comb through, work out which were the winners, which were the less good companies, and then figure out how to monetize some of those and really push the emerging winners into a position of leadership. So, and I built a team around that of around 10 people. So that was really the genesis. And I went to the board of this company, it's publicly listed, and said, look, I really believe with your time frame, because it was a permanent capital vehicle or is a permanent capital vehicle, with your time frame, with your focus on sort of the hierarchy of human needs, and this was a company that was in telecoms, media, and other sectors, healthcare is just a terrific fit. And they, very generously backed me to go build a healthcare business, critically in the US as well as Europe. And so that was my genesis. And one thing, sometimes a disadvantage can be an advantage. So I came to healthcare, I wasn't a physician. I'd spent my life in banking and primarily in technology banking. And I became a large investor in growth capital in the US, and probably the largest investor in growth capital in the US in healthcare. My advantage was I was not based in the US. And so I was coming to the US market for healthcare with an outsider's perspective. And and I had no brand name, and I had no relationships. So I had to sort of survive on my wits. And, in life, that's a tremendous, you're an entrepreneur. You've done that for a while. That's a tremendous impetus to, you know, to really do the work and figure out what is meaningful and what's useful versus, you know, what is, you know, perhaps less, you know, less important. And so I was able to do real bottom up work to figure out what I thought was going to move the needle in US healthcare and then back the companies that, were working on that.
And what were your kind of conclusions at that point about what would move the needle and how did it kind of pan out? Right, because that was probably what, like,
yeah, so
10 years ago, when, how long, I'm trying to, like,
yeah, it took a while. So, you know, I really spent a couple of years building the thesis, and then I made an investment a year for 5 years.
Okay.
And you know, a lot, and I doubled down in those, and so I committed, you know, well, you know, over $400, maybe $500 million. It's a very highly concentrated bet, to my earlier point. My first thesis was the digital front door, right? Yeah. Common thesis today, but you know, back in 2013, it felt that was needed, and it felt like telemedicine was going to be like telebanking, a brief period of change in modality, but not actually a change in practice.
Right.
And so I met Ali Parser and he had left Circle and he was going to start up Babylon. And so I put the first institutional check into that. And so that was that was obviously in the UK. And that was my thesis around taking AI, to create this sort of engaging consumer front door. And we can get back to it, but obviously that's a very difficult thesis to execute on.
Yeah. And by the way, Ali Parser, guest on the show previously, he has helped us back in our early days of starting PocDoc and has been someone that's been, on a personal level, someone that I have a lot of time for. I know that obviously things may not necessarily have worked out quite exactly the way that everybody hoped, but, you know, I just in the interest of full disclosure.
Yeah, and I think Ali's really a visionary, and, you know, I think he got a lot of things right. I think the timing and the execution were challenging, and, you know, we'll talk about it, but just how much capital you need to build in healthcare, it was also something that I think it made it difficult for him with the SPAC and then the subsequent change in market conditions. So that was a thesis. Thesis two was chronic condition management is critical. You know, we know that for now, you know, now, perhaps it was a little less apparent back then that the majority of folks who are elderly will have one or more comorbidities. These are behavioral conditions. And if you can find a way to treat these people who don't want to go into their GP or PCP on a weekly basis, you need to find a way to treat them and empower them to treat themselves. You could have a significant impact on the cost of care. And I was lucky enough, I focus on diabetes, given type 2 diabetes is so prevalent in the US. It's about 10% of the population and growing.
It's madness.
Madness. And so costly. And maybe GLP-1s ends up having a positive effect there. We'll see. But I was lucky enough to meet a terrific founder called Glenn Talman, building a business called Livongo, Live on the Go. And his son had been diagnosed with diabetes, and he sat in the hospital ward with his kid and promised, "I will find a solution for people with your condition."
I didn't know that was the story. That's a great story. I didn't know that was the origin. That's cool.
That's Glenn's origin story at Livongo, and obviously he's been a serial founder. And what Glenn did, and he, you know, in fairness, Glenn built it with one of my partners at GC and an outstanding individual called Hemant Taneja. And what they figured out was if you could marry hardware, software, and services together in healthcare in a closed loop system where the three interact, you could actually treat large volumes of patients incredibly well. And they bought a fingerprint device for blood testing, well before CGMs were on the market. Mm-hmm. They ensured that device was wireless connected. They married that with software that they built, and then services. And the software effectively delivered prompts to consumers on the device at the point of care saying, hey, look, your blood sugar levels are high or low, you need to do X, Y, Z. And like a ad tech business or like a Facebook, therefore, they got really, really good A/B testing messages, to understand what's Steve going to react to? What's Chris going to react to? Because they had this feedback loop, which is so rare in healthcare to have very fast feedback loops. And then at the end of that, they understood, look, we need humans in the loop, but very, very few humans to look after very large numbers of populations. And obviously the humans, the service level was informed by the software level. So they were, the humans called when your blood sugar levels were out of range, but were available if anybody had anxiety at any time. And I love that model in terms of, true tech-enabled services. It empowers the consumer. It leverages people at the top of their license. It delivers its services 24/7 at any address, and it creates terrific ROI. That was a real wonderful.
That was a win-win.
We scaled that business from when I invested. I think it had LTM revenue of around $15 million in a four-year period. We scaled it to somewhere like $350 million. And we were able to sell that for $18.5 billion to Teladoc, which ironically was that legacy telemedicine business that I had invested in Babylon to.
Yeah, to disintermediate, right?
Disintermediate. So, and in fact, they bought it, obviously, and I went on the board of Teladoc for a period of time. Teladoc bought it because they needed to move from that episodic acute care interaction with patients over the phone to something that was more longitudinal because they were getting commoditized, right? So I was right about the commoditization, and ironically the company I invested in on a longitudinal care basis was the one that they decided to buy to offset the commoditization. So that was the second thesis area.
Right. Cool. Okay, good. My producer's yelling at me that we have to go for our first commercial break. So we will be back after 2 minutes with Chris Bischoff, Managing Director of General Catalyst, the largest VC investor in early stage and growth health tech businesses in the world. We'll be right back. Thank you.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest, Chris Bischoff, who is the Managing Director of General Catalyst. So before the break, Chris had given us a fantastic range of the theses that Chris, you had given us, I'm not sure why I'm talking about you like you're not here. Chris, you had given us a fantastic overview of the theses that you use to build your investment sort of go to market, if you like, in the US. I want to switch it up a little bit now and just talk a little bit about where do you think investors can add the most value when things start to go a little bit wrong? Everyone obviously starts a business because they believe that business is going to be huge and successful, massively valuable, but you can't necessarily control things that are outside of your control. And so what are some of the best examples of investor behavior that you've seen, or some of the things where you really feel like you or others have added value when times have been tough? And like you mentioned it before, sometimes you have to give tough messages to founders. I just think it's an interesting area that sometimes doesn't get as much airtime as possible because everyone just wants to think about the good times.
Yeah, look, I think honesty in any relationship is critical. And I think you've got to earn trust. But once you've earned trust, I think investors owe it to be honest with founders. And I think investors can be peculiar beasts, right? Because one minute they're telling the founders to grow at all costs, and then next minute telling the founders, hey, cut that growth. We need to see profitability. And so, founders somehow, the good founders, I think, are good at balancing investors and saying, okay, well, I take this with a pinch of salt. For one, I think investors need to be honest. Two, they need to realize they're in the service of the company as well as their own fund, right? And mm-hmm. So I think when things get tough, sometimes investors go off in all different directions because they focus on perhaps, you know, their own particular priorities beyond those of the individual company. I think what we've seen through the reset post sort of 21, 22 is a real opportunity for a number of companies to go back and say, okay, you know, when I look at my business, did I overexpand? Is some of my revenue, you know, effectively lower margin revenue, less attractive revenue? You know, when I look at my cost base, is that really sustainable in a high cost of capital environment? You know, when I look at what I've done in terms of diversifying away from the core in terms of adjacencies, are all those really necessary? I think when capital is cheap, companies and investors, you know, really sort of risk taking their eye off the ball because it's easy to fund any type of growth. And When I think about healthcare, particularly on the delivery side, so much is local, you know, so much is density locally, and really focusing on the core. So, you know, for one, I think investors owe it to founders to say, as soon as a market changes or the business changes, okay, look, what are my expectations over the next 12 to 18 months? This is what, you know, you need to do in order to have a shot of, you know, further funding for myself or somebody else. So the founders have a clear position. They're not being sort of left in the loop, outside the loop rather, in terms of what they need to do, right? Because in any situation, if you can get out of a hole, you need that clarity. You know, second thing is, you know, as a founder is, you know, you eat an elephant, you know, morsel by morsel, right? Break it down.
How do you eat an elephant? One mouthful at a time.
Exactly. Right? So break it down. Every problem looks insurmountable at any point in time if you look at it in its entirety. But if you break it down, that's incredibly important. I do think companies that sometimes lose their way also have got into situations where not everybody in the organization is empowered and feels aligned. And I think it's a real opportunity for investors, well, investors and management, and particularly the founder, to sort of reset and re-incentivize folks about this is really what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. You know, really communicate to teams and empower teams to, you know, kind of help them make the calls that businesses need to make to change rather than a top-down, hey, we're changing, you know, live with it. Empower the C-suite and the leadership to say, okay, look, we need to change tack. We need to pivot. We need to do X or Y or Z. We're doing this together. And it's not the board is telling me, the CEO, to do it. You know, we're telling the board this is how we're going to do it. So yeah. I do think it's important for management teams to be empowered. Look, it's in tough times, it requires more communication. But getting through those periods is always just incredibly satisfying. And I think every business has those tough times, right? And even
rarely is it just completely plain sailing.
I don't know. It's plain sailing. Right. And it always looked, you know, worse, you know, at that point when you're looking into that abyss, right? It always looks like, woof, you know, how are we going to get through this? But, you know, so many great companies were born in market downturns. So many great companies went through that period where their metal was tested and came out the other side. And they may have pivoted their business model or done something different. But there's incredible discipline that, you know, a lack of access to funding, high cost of capital puts on businesses. I mean, that's the private equity model, ultimately, high cost of capital. And you've got to run this business with an enormous amount of debt that pressurizes your cash flow. So you've got to be really careful, right? So some of that, you know, it's great to refocus and then obviously grow from there. You know, I'm much rather a business. I say to entrepreneurs, I or we as a firm would much rather take a hit on the business and regrow from a lower base at a higher rate than have artificially high numbers that you can't grow because, you know, the quality of that revenue or earnings.
Yeah, you've basically goosed it right up and then you can't get any further because, and then you're kind of committed to try and make it look better and make it look better and you're not addressing the core problems and all those kind of things. Completely
exactly.
Understand.
Right. Now, it's hard to do that, right? Investors may need to take marks, management, you know, may need to do some changes, right? But if you can get that done, wow, it's easier, you know, it's easier the other side of that tough decision.
Yeah, I remember. So when I was one of the early employees at a business called Viagogo, which became very large and subsequently has bought back the founder's previous company, StubHub, for $4 billion in cash. So, you know, I started there in early 2008, just before the financial crash. Then capital got cheap again and we grew again off the back of quite a lot of capital. The founder was very, very good at raising money. Then there was another contraction and we had to go through a phase of exactly what you said, which was effectively the market no longer values top line growth. The market values profitability. And it was that lesson watching the founder who I worked for directly go through every unit of the business and understand how that role contributed to the contribution or net contribution or, you know, EBITDA, and go through that with a fine tooth comb and make those tough decisions was an incredibly insightful lesson. You know, and we went from burning millions a month to being EBITDA positive within about 3 or 4 months, just purely because there was so much stuff that was happening that didn't make any sense. But because capital was cheap, we just didn't really need to look at it. We didn't have that discipline.
Yeah. And startups die primarily because they run out of money, right?
Yeah,
so at some point, you need to find a way to either increase your revenue or reduce cost, right? When times get tough. But yes, that's a good example.
So let's just change ever so slightly. So let's go back to Teladoc and Livongo, because I think it's a really good case study in a lot of different ways. And it'd be great if we can just kind of unpick it without, you know, breaching any secret squirrel kind of, you know, confidentiality or anything like that. Because the reason why I like it is partly because of exactly how you described it, which was there was a, I would say, early stage digital business that was really a old business with a sort of digital layer to it, which was telehealth, basically becoming highly commoditized in a highly competitive market, supply constrained because there's only a finite number of doctors and clinicians, demand growing, but other market entrants coming in, probably race to the bottom in terms of unit revenue and things like that. So, and then they make a call, which is to buy this new business called Livongo for the reasons that you laid out, a higher ROI, repeat usage, you know, better product, completely different, but also aligned with this sort of space. And so how well do you think Teladoc integrated that business into the overall? Because Teladoc is a big business, and it was a big business when they bought it. So how well did they go about kind of integrating that, or did they run it as a kind of a separate play?
So yeah, so that's a really good question. And I think, look, I spent, as I said, 13 years as a banker, and M&A, the hard work starts once you've bought the company, right?
Yeah.
And I think in hindsight, obviously 2020, they probably underinvested in integration. And it's tough on these. One was a largely West Coast culture, and one, that being Livongo, a tech culture with tech compensation models, and obviously a number of employees that had, you know, being able to achieve kind of significant personal wealth.
Like life-changing personal wealth.
Life-changing personal wealth. Then to become employees of an East Coast, more traditional firm, you know, much larger, much more bureaucratic, you can see that sort of meshing those two cultures was really, really challenging. And so I think theory and practice in M&A are very, very different. And, you know, that's why I counsel founders to be very cautious about M&A. And if they're going to do it, really thinking about that cultural fit day one. So much of it comes down to that, right? Because if you've got good cultural fit, that the challenges that will come with integration, and there will be one, there'll be dis-synergies as well as synergies, you have a shot at overcoming those. If you disregard culture, I think it becomes incredibly hard, you know, to make these things effective, no matter what the logic is of the combination. And I think that was the challenge at Teladoc. I think part of the reason why it was difficult was also Teladoc's core business was, as you say, under significant threat as that market commoditized during COVID and post. Look, Teladoc's a terrific company. They do, you know, well over $2 billion of sales now, and are growing, you know, even despite their size, are growing at 30% plus a year.
Is that what their growth is? 30%? Ooh, that's pretty good in that market.
So, you know, in the end of the day, it's not meteoric growth, but and maybe it's 25%, but it's still, you know, not pedestrian. And I think Livongo has been critical to adding capabilities to what they do, particularly as they try to diversify away from the commoditization by providing value-based care arrangements. And I'm happy to, you know, talk a little bit about that. But that was one of the impetuses. And I think if you think about where Teladoc ends up, if they can provide value-based virtual care, I think that will be the way to offset commoditization.
Well, I think this value-based care thing we can get onto, obviously, because that was the sort of thesis that Babylon sort of pursued in the US, and it'd be great to get your thoughts on that. I think I completely agree with you, which is if you can land digital first value-based care, if you can really execute on that, that is extremely lucrative if you can get to that point. And by that, I mean, not only can you execute on the actual product, but it does actually deliver for patients.
Value-based care, as you know, but the audience might not, is it's only lucrative if it delivers for the patient, because if you don't deliver the patient, that there is no margin for the provider. So yes, I think that was Ali's thesis, because he saw the commoditization. He was a new entrant to the US market. There was no way he was going to beat Teladoc in terms of basic telemedicine, but the execution is extremely hard, as Ali found out. And, you know, Teladoc is easing into virtual value-based care. And I would say there's really only a handful of companies in the US that have been able to execute that strategy in any way or shape or form. And the ones that have done best are actually being payviders who obviously control the premium as well as the delivery side of the business, which makes it a little...
So they can control their revenue a bit more, right? Because they can flex it up if they need to. Is that what that means?
Well, it means that they can control the terms under which they provide virtual value-based care, because they own the delivery system, right? So one of the challenges in value-based care is the negotiation with a payer over what is included, what is not included, how you determine value. You know, value is not a hard objective measure. And so a lot of startups in the US have really struggled outside of contracts with CMS to really get agreement with payers over what is value and how to measure it. If you're a payvider, you control both the payer and the provider. It's a wash effectively because...
Right. It's a full stack, right? You own the value chain, basically. It's like Live Nation in entertainment. You're the promoter, the ticketing company, the parking lot, the venue hall, the whole thing.
Yeah, you're taking the risk anyway. It just depends. Are you taking in the insurer or are you taking the provider? It's in your business.
Okay. Well, look, on that, we'll come back to that after our final short break. This is the final break in this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest, Chris Bischoff, Managing Director of General Catalyst.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello, and welcome back to the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest, Chris Bischoff, the Managing Director of General Catalyst. So, Chris, just before the break, we were getting into value-based care. So as we are a broad church, I'm sure there's people listening who understand what that means, and there's probably people that don't. So just correct me if I'm wrong, but value-based care is fundamentally where a company, for example, well, it could be Teladoc, it could be anyone, ultimately is paid a fixed amount to deliver all the care for a certain patient for 12 months. Is that correct or incorrect?
Yeah, so that exactly right, Steve. So that's the basis of the model. Effectively, the payer will take a margin for customer acquisition if they have to acquire the customer and administration, and then pass on the rest of the premium for the insurance to the provider to deliver that care. And if the provider is able to deliver that care at a lower cost than the revenue they receive, they make it a margin. If they don't, they lose money. That creates incredible incentive alignment. And one of the challenges in healthcare is incentive alignment, particularly with a fee-for-service model where, you know, utilization is obviously encouraged, right? Because if you're a doctor and or a nurse practitioner or whatever else, you know, why wouldn't you utilize more? And why wouldn't you in a fee-for-service world just treat the person who comes through the door rather than take a look at your panel and say, whoa, you know, who out there could be either high risk or emerging risk of some sort of condition that could lend them up in the ER or some sort of inpatient setting. And since the ER and inpatient settings are the highest cost part of the healthcare delivery ecosystem, avoiding patient time there through preventative care is enormously beneficial to the health system, right? And patient outcomes are also cheaper to deliver, right? So the value-based model is all about saying, how can I do what's called population health, spend time with the people who need my care most as a healthcare provider, rather than the people who walk through the door, because I'm incentivized on taking care of those.
Yeah, and I think that's critical. It's the incentive, selection pressure, however you want to talk about it, which is there is a upside in and a down as an upside if you do and a downside if you don't focus on the most urgent people first, in effect, or the most high-risk people.
And I think one of the challenges is, so this is a challenge I mentioned, this is a challenge economically to figure out how these contracts are structured, and you need actuaries and payers and providers agonize over, you know, what are the exclusions and all the rest. But then it's very hard from a healthcare practitioner point of view. If you've been taught to practice in fee-for-service, to transition to value is not easy. And there's a real change management need to make that happen. And you need physician leaders to really bring practices along. And you need the tools to do population health well, right? So
you really do. Because if you don't have the tools, then it's not going to go anywhere. It's going
to
go
out. That's right. You don't know who you need to look after, right?
No.
So you tools that dashboards that tell you, okay, look, based on claims, you know, based on medical records, you know, a Chris or a Steve needs to be visited. And, you know, what is so empowering for this model is you can then decide what money to spend. You can say, well, if Chris needs some, you know, help with food or housing or other social determinants of health, you can spend that money, because ultimately you're taking risk as the provider. You don't have to think, okay, well, is there a billing code for this? And if there's not, I can't do it.
Well, and also like, well, goodness me, I've always got a completely full ER, so I can't move cost out of there because I've always got to staff that. And that always has to be that way because it always is that way. Whereas in this model, you're incentivized to take decisions that, like you say, fund other things that you might believe in the medium to long term might pay off. Because you have a financial incentive to do so and the freedom to do so, because you've added that element of financial risk, capitalism, whatever you want to call it, into the system, I guess. That would be how I think
about
it.
Absolutely right. So where is it difficult? It's difficult in the commercial population in the US where, as you know, in the US, a large number of people receive their healthcare through their employer. And because the labor force, one of the incredible things about the US is the labor force is very liquid. But that means people churn on average their job every 3 years. And therefore, if the insurer is only keeping the patient for 3 years because the member moves when the person moves jobs, they're not per se incentivized as much to think about longitudinal care, right? Because if somebody gets sick 10 years down the line, why should they invest today? In models like the UK, where we have, you know, a national payer, we should be ideally suited to longitudinal care. And we have huge amounts of data potentially available to us. So one of the challenges in these models is how do you put it into practice in, you know, in parts of the healthcare insurance market where people churn a lot. That impacts obviously the employers in the US in that employer funded plans. It also impacts Medicaid in the US, which is the largest single payer in the US. It's for disadvantaged people. They churn in and out. It's most effective in Medicare, which is for elderly, because obviously once you're elderly,
static,
you stay elderly.
Yeah, that makes sense. So let's, because this is this area is where Ali at Babylon moved into in the US, which drove the massive increase in revenues that we saw ahead of the listing or the SPAC listing. And so just to try and break it up, because I know there's been a lot of people that have heaped a lot of schadenfreude on the situation, which I think kind of clouds the issue. But was the thesis correct in what he was trying to do, which was virtual value-based care? And it was more of an execution or a market issue that meant it ended up the way that it did? Or was there something different about the way that he or Babylon approached value-based care that meant it was just harder for them from the get-go?
So I think the thesis was right. But, you know, in the end of the day, execution is everything, right? And so in value-based care, so effectively what Ali did was he bought into value-based care delivery businesses, providers, and then used Babylon and the services Babylon has as a wraparound for those providers and those tools that I mentioned to help them practice better in value-based care. That's really, really hard to do. And there are a number of MSOs in the US that are out there. MSOs are organizations that provide these wrappers for practices to move from fee-for-service to value. But Ali had some execution questions. He also, and I think this is a lesson that Ali has been vocal about, was he took on debt. And startups, you know what, at times debt can look attractive because in certain markets, debt can be cheap and certainly cheaper than equity. The challenge, obviously, always with debt is that it has to be repaid.
And you've got to pay the bill.
With equity, you know, ultimately investors, you know, understand they're taking junior risk in the cap table, and you know, there's always going to be a chance of a write-off. So I think you know, at the end of the day, the debt holders of the business, you know, didn't give him the leeway to execute, and he was unable to raise equity at a price he felt appropriate for the business. I'm not personally involved in Babylon, haven't been for a long time, but I would say thesis-wise, absolutely correct. And you know, the two big levers for change in healthcare are one, technology, and two, change of incentives. And you know, he was trying to use technology through Babylon, and then obviously a value-based payment model for incentives. So I'm a great believer in that. And I think, you know, that will, you know, time will show that businesses can succeed in both those models. We've seen really good digital businesses, and we've seen really good value-based businesses. We've seen very few digital value-based businesses succeed so far, but that will happen.
That makes total sense. So is the majority of the system in the US now value-based care, or is it still there's a bit of a debate and some of it's fee-for-service and some people are value, or like has the argument been decided, or is it still sort of up for debate?
So it's by no means the majority, and value-based is a broad church. So if you take value-based as somebody, as a provider working under financial performance incentives or performance incentives on cost of care, right? You could say that's value-based, right? There's upside and downside sharing. There's bonus payments if they do well. In that very thin definition of value, rather than sort of full capitation, i.e. full downside risk and upside, there's quite a lot of providers. But in the true application sense of taking all the upside and downside risk, it's still very early days. As I said, it's most prevalent in Medicare, which is, since the US, like Europe, is an aging population, is a very large part of the market. It's becoming more prevalent in Medicaid and the crossover between Medicaid and Medicare duals. It's almost non-existent in the commercial population, which is obviously a significant part of the market. So actually, it's most prevalent in the government-sponsored part of the market, where the taxpayers footing the bill, and CMS, which is the regulator in the US, is creating these models for practices to practice under value-based contracts. So the US has got a long way to run. The other thing, just obviously to say, there are a number, if you're a hospital system and you have a large number of beds and you rely on the ER to make you hit your revenue numbers, value-based care may not actually sound a terrific
that good idea. Right? That's the weird perverse incentives, like the kind of Freakonomics of the US, the healthcare system.
Absolutely right. So and remember, hospital systems in the US, they rely on debt. They're big businesses. And so to transition to value is hard, you know, is really hard for them. Large businesses, and they struggle. And so some of them have and some of them don't have downstream provider groups, right? And so if you have a downstream provider group that is sort of primary care focused, you can practice in value and capture the value through your own provider network, right?
Yeah, that's like owning the value chain that we talked about. Right. Like it's all.
But if you're just a hospital system, which is a high cost center of care, that's tough. The other thing is that payers in the US don't always love giving away value-based contracts to systems and providers, because they say, well, look, we want to capture some of that value, right? If you're CMS, right, you're a government entity, that's not your primary objective, right? But if you're a commercial payer, you may say, well, why would I do a value-based contract with you? Because you will recoup the benefits versus potentially my own provider network, because some of the payers in the US, you know, have large provider networks.
Yeah.
And so it could be, even if your system would like to practice in value, maybe they don't have their own provider group. And maybe the payer dynamics in their own state makes it incredibly hard for them to do so. So they would have to then launch their own plan, insurance plan, which is complicated and costly to do. So even if there's some sort of difficulties from a change in business model, there are also some structural issues that make that difficult for systems. And remember, in the US healthcare system, about a third to a half of care is delivered through health systems, right? So you need those to change. Now, there's some great ones. One of my colleagues, Mark Harrison, ran Intermountain. He switched it largely to value, but he owned the payer, or Intermountain owns the payer in Utah, right? So he was able to work because they have the
payer. He had
the stack.
Yeah, he had the stack. So we're into the last few minutes of the show. When we wrap up, what I like to do is ask people just for, you know, more of a personal kind of take on things. So in your experience, very quickly, in a minute or two, of all the businesses that you've been involved in, what are the commonalities either around the product, the approach, the mindset, the founders? What are some of the things that you would say are the top three things that you've seen are sort of indicators that those companies have a better shot versus a less good shot, or that those founders have a better shot versus a less good shot?
I think intentionality, right? Healthcare is hard. This is not for people who sort of want to follow momentum, right? So what is the problem you are trying to solve? Do you have lived experience in that problem, or do you have a particular insight that gives you a different perspective? Because again, the best businesses in healthcare find a way to operate outside or at the margin of the existing system, but ultimately to integrate back into that system, right? Because you change directly in the system doing just the same thing is very, very hard, because the sales cycle and the inertia in healthcare and all those incentives we talked about. So intentionality, some sort of vision that is orthogonal, a little different, to the way things work today, right? We need to make healthcare better. We can't just do the same. I think incredible grittiness and passion about what they're building and what they're doing, and a certain sort of bravery around it, right? This is not for the faint-hearted. I think are really key factors. In the end of the day, we believe strongly that they have to be responsible, and they're building responsibly. And we have to, they have to use technology to make a difference, right?
Perfect.
We don't have enough healthcare workers. So those will be some of the criteria.
That's wonderful, Mark. We've literally run out of time. So Mark Bischoff, thank you very much for coming on the show. Mark Bischoff, General MD of General Catalyst. Thank you very much for everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week.
Thank you.